This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. And here is CBS News business analyst Jill Schlesinger. One positive piece of economic news is that the dollar is very, very strong. So shouldn't that be good for those of us who have dollars in our savings accounts?
It's definitely good, especially if you like to buy imported goods. So, you know, if you like French cheese or British gin, this is a good time for you. Or if you're traveling abroad, it's good to be an American traveling abroad with a strengthening dollar. Here's who it's not so good for. Let's just say you're a large employer in Seattle like Boeing, and you've got to sell your American-made product overseas, and that overseas currency has dropped dramatically against the U.S. dollar. It makes your airplane more expensive in that local currency. And as a result, if you're sitting in Europe or Asia and you say, oh, the Airbus is almost as good as the Boeing, but it costs a lot less, I might shift my buy to the foreign-made product. So it's not great for big exporters that are U.S.-based.
But isn't this supposed to control inflation in some way by making the dollar stronger?
I mean, the connection among all of these theories is hard to see in minute to minute. But generally, when we see the U.S. Federal Reserve raising interest rates faster than other central banks, which it has done, it does boost the value of the dollar and potentially means that dollars will stay in the United States, flow into the United States, and that that supply of dollars will maybe go into saving, not in necessarily into investing, by the way, and that should help slow down this pace of inflation. But as a reminder, there are two sides to the economic equation that the Fed is really looking at. It is good old supply and demand. The Fed raising interest rates can push down demand, seeing that kind of in the housing market. What the Fed can't do is control supply. So think of three huge areas of the economy: energy, food, and shelter. With energy, we knew that it was likely that energy prices would come down as the war in Ukraine kind of pushed things really higher on fears. And basically, the supply has sort of has been sorted out a little bit more. And as people fear a recession, the demand for energy products might drop. So we've seen oil and gas prices come down. Look at food. The food index is still incredibly high, up over 11% from a year ago. And the Fed cannot control that a third of the world's food comes from the Ukraine, the breadbasket of Europe. And third, shelter. The Federal Reserve is not building new houses. We don't have a lot of houses for sale. People who have ultra low mortgage rates are not moving. New construction is lagging. So the Fed can't just have poof create housing for people. So when we think about the Federal Reserve's impact on inflation and the economy, it may be that the Fed really can only control this demand side, and we've just got to wait for supply to sort itself out.
Well, the question is how long? You know, you mentioned investors. So much for buying the dip, right? Every dip is is followed by a deeper dip.
I got a great question from a friend of mine over the weekend, and she wrote to me, is it possible my 401k will be at the exact same value 2 years from now when I retire? Mm-hmm. And I said, it is highly unlikely. Of course, I said it could be lower.
Great.
So, okay, that's a little joke. Don't get upset, everyone. If you are an investor, you are investing for the long term. Here's what we know. If you not buy the dips, but if you stick to your consistent investment philosophy, like, for example, you put a little bit of money away every paycheck into a 401k, or you have some money put aside for your IRA. If you do that, you will probably be just fine because you're looking at a 10, 15, 20-year time horizon. And I would even say that if you are investing and your retirement is coming up really soon, you're not just investing for 2 years from now, with all due respect to my friend. She's 66 years old. Mm-hmm. If she retires when she's 68, that money still has to last her for 25 years. So she doesn't need all of the money at once. It is unnerving. It's awful. No one's going to make you feel good about this. But if you stick to your game plan and you don't become reactive, you will probably be okay.
Do you still think the Fed is doing the right thing? Are they doing a good job?
I mean, I think the Fed has not a lot of great choices. I am somewhat concerned that the Fed is going to keep going in an effort to like really push down demand. And by the time we figure out like, okay, that's enough, it will have gone too far. So the risk of a recession induced by the Federal Reserve and high inflation is escalating. There's no way around it. And I think that most people expect a pretty a decent slowdown next year. What we hope about the next recession, and we will get another recession, that it is shallow and short. Shallow and short, better than deep and long. You know one thing that's fascinating, though? Think about this. When's the last time that we had a recession as the economy was creating hundreds of thousands of jobs per month and there were more than 11 million job openings? That would be the first of never.
That's so puzzling.
I know. And that's why when you talk to economists, they really are scratching their heads. Maybe we could be nicer to economists because someone sent me a note that was like, these economists stink. I hate them. And I would let's think about them as meteorologists. Okay. You're a meteorologist. We're talking about a hurricane in Florida, right?
Yes.
So you got all the greatest models in the world. And what does a meteorologist will say to us? Like, prepare for the worst, evacuate, do that. But based on the way the wind moves, things that are out of our control, it may be worse. It may be better than we anticipate. It's kind of how economists are also. And, you know, I am hopeful that the hurricane does not hit with gale force winds on landfall when it comes to the economy. But if it does, if you prepare, if you do your best to kind of look at those emergency reserves, beef them up, if you are very clear that you've got to pay down high interest debt while you do have a job, if you are really looking at your job and instead of just jumping from one to the other, figure out a place that values you and wants to keep you where you can really feel more secure. Those are the kinds of things we'd want you to do in the face of a recession.
I see. And as with a hurricane, nail up plywood over your computer screen and don't look at your account statement.
You know what? We are a great team. That is perfect, and I'm stealing that from you.
CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Thank you, Jill.
My pleasure.
6:37, Seattle's morning news. An accident that left a Western Washington man unable to walk inspired him to help other people. Here's Current News Radio's Heather Bosch with our charity of the month.
When Logan Seeley looks at the typical house,
pretty much everything about this house is a challenge.
A challenge when you rely on a wheelchair.
The hallways are very narrow. The bathroom is tiny. It's your typical tub. So for me to get in and out of the shower, I kind of have to pick my legs up while I'm kind of holding onto the wall.
Seeley was left partially paralyzed in a high school football accident nearly 20 years ago. But something his coach said always stuck with him.
Life is 10% what happens to me and 90% how I react to it.
So Seeley founded the 10 and 90 Foundation to help others who have spinal cord injuries react in a way that helps them survive and thrive. He offers them grants.
Whether it's a little bit of money to help pay for a few sessions of therapy, or it's a little bit more money to help pay for part of a handicap accessible vehicle.
Because, he says, the cost of adapting your environment and ongoing treatment.
These costs can just pile up and pile up to the point where, you know, it could just bankrupt somebody. And so that's why I started the foundation. We're not nearly big enough or have the resources enough to fully help someone pay for all the therapy or new chair, but we try to give as much as we can to help push them in the right direction.
His charity also funds a scholarship for athletes who contribute on and off the field. Heather Bosch, Cairo News Radio.
It is 6:38. Overseas, election results in Italy show a party with neo-fascist roots, the Brothers of Italy, has swept the national elections. This would lead to Italy's first far-right government since World War II and make its leader, Giorgia Meloni, Italy's first female premier. Turnout was 64%, Italy's lowest turnout ever. In her victory speech, Meloni said she would govern on behalf of all Italians.
Because the great objective that we've always had as a political force is that of ensuring Italians may once again be proud to be Italians.
The Italian Democratic Party's candidate, Deborah Serracchini, conceded and said the center-left would be a strong opposition force.
Tonight, considering the numbers we have seen so far, we can't deny the right has won, led by Giorgia Meloni. We think this is a sad night for our country, because for us, this is not a positive outcome.
And while Meloni's party may have fascist roots, it is not pro-Putin. However, it is not friendly to liberals on social issues. Here's the BBC's Lee Milner.
A Meloni-led Italy will alarm much of Europe, with Russia at war in Ukraine. But unlike her right-wing allies, she has openly said she is pro-NATO, has no time for Vladimir Putin. Although she has worked hard to soften her image, she leads a party rooted in a post-war movement that rose out of Benito Mussolini's fascists. Still embracing their old slogan, God, Fatherland and Family, she campaigns against LGBT rights and is calling for a naval blockade of Libya to stop migrant boats.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. How is it that some of us never got COVID? Let's page the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, I saw a study which concluded that some foods can mimic the effects of COVID vaccines. And at first I thought, okay, clickbait, but I thought we should run it by you first. So what can you tell us about this research?
I think that why some people don't get COVID is complicated. You know, I myself have never gotten COVID, despite working in a high-risk environment, and I've wondered why that wasn't the case. And, you know, I take certain supplements that are speculated to help fight off viral illnesses, and also I've always wondered about working in a children's hospital and being exposed to viruses all the time. Does that give you some immunity because you get constant low-level exposure? But this is a hot topic, and there was a paper in Frontiers in Immunology that suggested that common foods or other vaccines or other bacteria and viruses may all actually prime our immune system to attack the SARS-CoV-2 virus. This study looked at the possibility that certain foods that we ate that actually would be technically classified as a food allergy may actually prime our immune systems and protect us from getting COVID.
Yeah, because, I mean, if your immune system reacts to a food, like you said, that's a food allergy. That would, what, give you a runny nose and make you feel sick. But you're saying at the same time, it might have actually primed your immune system to fight off SARS-CoV-2, huh?
So that's correct. But in this case, we're talking about people who actually eat food and they have a leaky gut. And so it allows the food that they eat to actually transmit some of the antigen into their bloodstream, and then they develop antibodies to it. You know, there's no one suggesting here that, of course, that it would be possible to eat your way to COVID immunity, but that it may be one of the things that explains why some people get COVID and others don't, or why some people get desperately ill from COVID, whereas others don't.
Leaky gut doesn't sound good. I mean, did they track people who have these food allergies to determine how many of them got COVID, or did they mix the proteins together to see which ones seem to mimic the virus? How did they conduct the research?
The study was really more speculative in nature, trying to understand what the possibilities were. It was more, you know, a theoretical discussion on why this is the case. Of course, they don't eliminate the possibility of there being genetic predispositions, or that, you know, some people just have better immune systems. But in this case, they're really speculating that one of the possibilities is simply the foods that we eat.
Now, I noticed that they actually listed some specific foods whose proteins seem to mimic the SARS-CoV-2, including almond, broccoli, soy, cashew, milk, pork, pineapple, and some kind of lentil preparation. So, I mean, do you, that's obviously something that people will look at and say, yikes, I should eat more of that.
Right, except that these are the foods that many people describe having allergies to, right?
Yeah.
Nut allergies for almonds and cashews. milk allergies, soy allergies. These are foods that many people already have allergies to. Or, for example, it's well known that if you eat a lot of soy, that over time you can develop what amounts to an allergy to soy. You can become intolerant of it. So, you know, these are foods that are pretty allergenic to begin with. It just may be that there's enough of a reaction because of the, you know, leaky gut that's caused by some of these foods. If you have a sensitivity to it, that it then, again, gets into your bloodstream, you develop antibodies, and it just so happens that there's enough similarity with the SARS-CoV-2 virus that it actually vaccinates you to the virus itself, but in a natural way rather than through a injected vaccine.
So then is eating broccoli and these nuts and these other foods, is that a wise thing to do for your own peace of mind? Or is it sort of a catch-22 where the only food that actually might protect you against the COVID infection is the food that you're allergic to and generate a response to?
Yeah, I don't think that's realistic. I think what they're saying is that people who have allergies, who have food sensitivities to these particular things, may in fact have, as a side effect of that, some natural immunity to the SARS-CoV-2 virus. But I don't think it represents any sort of opportunity to develop your own natural immunity at the moment.
So you can't use this as a sledgehammer to get people to eat their broccoli.
No, but they should eat their broccoli. It's
they
good
should.
For
That's
it.
Right. Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thanks very much.
Thanks, Dave.
Monday morning and time for Cairo News Radio's Hannah Scott's Crime and Punishment Report. This morning we have a bank robber, a pharmacy thief, and a murderer. And tell us what their consequences turned out to be, Hannah.
Good morning, Dave. So our first case involves a man named Alec Bridges, who robbed a Kirkland bank last year.
People have this idea that when you rob a bank, that you get a huge haul of money, like the bank robbers of 100 years ago. And maybe that also comes from the Hollywood Bandit, who was in Seattle in the 1990s, who got a pretty big haul. But you really don't anymore. And so it's if people are ever on the fence about robbing a bank, which I'm not sure why you would be, but it's really a terrible idea because you don't get much other than a felony charge.
Casey McNerthney with the King County Prosecutor's Office says that's what we saw in this case.
The banks rarely say how much money is taken in robberies, but the sentencing details like you see here do. The defendant here robbed a bank and got $985. $985 to rob a bank? Wow, that's really not what people think it is. But he also got a GPS tracker, and that helped Kirkland police do really great work to get him and also found the gloves that he discarded. This guy had a previous felony history, and when you have a felony history like that, your DNA goes into the CODIS database, which is a statewide and national database for people who are convicted of felonies and certain misdemeanors. And then the DNA from crime scenes goes in there and makes a pretty quick link of who that DNA belongs to.
And that's how they were able to track him down in this case. Now, it's not clear what drove him to rob the bank. His previous history had involved assault and unlawful possession of a gun. No clear idea on what exactly drove him to rob this bank. But the consequence for robbing a bank?
Even with his previous convictions, he had an offender score of 3. The range that's set by state lawmakers is 13 to 17 months. And so a judge on Friday went for the low end there, went for 13 months. But prosecutors are really thankful for the work of Kirkland police here, who did a great job to get this investigation handled and sent to us so we could file that charge.
So he was convicted on Friday. Again, the message there, $985, probably not worth it to try to rob a bank.
No.
In case number 2.
Muhammad Ahmed is a person who was robbing pharmacies in February of 2021 with a handgun. People hear about these pharmacy robberies on the news every so often, but it's rare to hear what happens afterwards. And King County prosecutors routinely file these cases when we have the evidence to do so. And we get convictions, just like we did here and with the sentence on Friday. Ahmed was armed with a handgun that he wasn't supposed to have, robbed multiple pharmacies, and he was looking for what people typically do in those pharmacy robberies. They're looking for pain pills.
Casey says it's important to remember in cases like this.
This is very traumatizing for people who are on the other end of the counter in these pharmacy robberies. They certainly conveyed to investigators and prosecutors about how traumatizing this was for them. And even with a conviction, that really doesn't go away. And it's easy to overlook for people, the victims in these cases, but they should not be forgotten. And prosecutors certainly don't forget them.
Now, the end result in this case?
He was guilty as charged to the two robbery counts that were charged and also unlawful gun possession in the first degree. He was sentenced to 77 total months, which is in line. That's about 6.5 years with the statewide sentencing guidelines that were set by state lawmakers. Also was ordered by a judge on Friday to have an evaluation for substance abuse and alcohol abuse and was told by the court to follow all the recommendations that come with that evaluation. He also had a co-defendant in this case that earlier this year pleaded guilty and told the court that he's enrolled in treatment and that was a significant factor. That's positive news to see, but we also, you know, really the message that we want to share out of this is that prosecutors certainly don't, and we hope the public does not forget the victims of these pharmacy robberies who really are traumatized and never really get the closure that you hope they get.
And Casey says the final case involves a man who killed his girlfriend.
Joe Gongora was found guilty as charged for a 2020 murder in Seattle. In September of 2020, he was living with his girlfriend, and they moved here from Texas. He was in his 30s working a retail job. Things seemed fine initially, and they had been dating off and on since 2013. As his defense attorney told the court, things went downhill when he started having paranoid delusions, and he thought that people were tormenting him and listening in to what he was saying with electronic devices. He eventually was diagnosed with unspecified schizophrenia. He took a trip to Texas, his hometown, where his family was pretty concerned about him, and then came back to Seattle and was having one of those delusions when he shot his girlfriend twice.
A really tragic case. Casey says the prosecutor's office recently took a deep dive into domestic violence cases.
Domestic violence murders like this are tracked by David Martin, and David and his team in the domestic violence unit at the King County Prosecutor's Office are arguably the best in the nation at tracking these cases and handling them. What David did is he got the data from the medical examiner's office for deaths going back 25 years, back to 1997. And for the first time in King County history, reviewed each of those cases to see what trends we find around domestic violence. And so he has the data that provides a much clearer picture on how significant the domestic violence concerns are in King County. And what that data shows is that in 2020, you know, and certainly the pandemic had an effect on this, we had a record number of DV cases at 30. There were 30 domestic violence deaths in King County, and that's an unusually high number. In the years since 2020, the numbers have been less, but still unusually high compared to what some previous years have been.
And Casey says in this particular case, it stands out.
What's unique about the defendant in this case is that he had no criminal history until his mental health deteriorated. This murder was his first known crime. And so because of that, the statewide range that's set by lawmakers, even with being guilty as charged for a murder case, is roughly 10 to 18 years for this woman's death. The judge on Friday sentenced him to 216 months, 18 years, the high end of the range there, and also ordered him to go through evaluations for alcohol and substance abuse, which was a factor in his life, and follow all the recommendations there. Certainly not an outcome that provides any closure, because you never really get that, but it is the high end of what prosecutors were able
to get. So, again, that was a strange case because he had no criminal history. He had some involvement with some drugs that possibly led to some of the delusions he was having, but really kind of came out of nowhere. A very tragic case.
Yeah. So in any of these cases, I mean, these are all cases of people who are making really, really bad decisions that to most of us seem like obviously bad decisions. So when they come out after these sentences, will they have at least some decision-making skills, or are they simply sitting there reading paperbacks for all that?
They don't get a lot. Again, this is a work in progress where they're trying to get better reentry programs for folks who go to prison for things like this. In the last case, there's a possibility of some treatment that could come from, it would be up to the corrections department, basically. So it's a case by case basis. Mm-hmm. But we don't have in this state a wide program to make sure that all these folks, when they do come out of jail, have the skills and the you know, decision making skills specifically that they might need. Hopefully that will change, especially for that last guy during the years that he's in prison, and there's a better system in place by the time he gets out.
Well, that would be wise, it seems to me.
Yes, I agree.
KR News Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Why don't you think he'll talk to us again? He's going to write another book, right?
That's true.
He needs us. Your daily dose of kindness brought to you by Baird. An unexpected friendship brings a 9-year-old the comfort and confidence she needs. Here's CBS's Steve Hartman.
I'm over here.
When people first
mercy, 9-year-old Carson Majors of Encinitas, California. Almost everyone jumps to the same conclusion. But she doesn't have cancer.
Good job.
She's fine.
Easy.
She just has alopecia universalis, an autoimmune disease that results in near total hair loss. Carson began showing symptoms at the age of 6, and within 2 years, her flowing blonde locks were completely gone.
I like to do my hair a lot, but then it fell out, so.
Carson says it still bothers her at times.
Because I miss my hair.
But she says her attitude improved dramatically after a chance meeting on the lacrosse field.
When you first saw her, what did you think?
She was like so nice, pretty, beautiful, cool. She was way older than me.
But equally bald.
She's like, do you have alopecia? I was like, yeah. Do you? She's like, yeah. It was a moment of awe, especially because the sun was setting. It was just like shining down. It was like perfect.
17-year-old Scarlett Hall says she used to hate her hair loss too. But her attitude also improved dramatically after meeting Carson.
Scarlett!
Carson! Hi, kid. I got a best friend. I got a mini-me.
Alopecia in children is rare, which is why Scarlett decided it was especially important.
You too.
Not only to engage with Carson that first day, but to remain a presence in her life.
I want to be able to show her that, like, you're perfect. You don't need to look like the people in the magazine cover.
And by all accounts, that message is getting through.
Did she help make you more comfortable with who you are?
Yes.
By something she said or just the way she was?
The way she was.
So friends make that big a difference.
Did you not know that?
I had an inkling, but now I believe it even more.
Two besties, showing the world that hair should never be top of mind and that bold is beautiful. Steve Hartman.
That's perfect.
On the road in Encinitas, California.
That's a sweet story.
It is a sweet story. And now from the G and Ursula Show, which starts at 9 here in Cairo News Radio, here's G. Scott. Before we get to the new and improved Pro Bowl, the Seahawks lost the must-win game. So what does that mean?
Man, first of all, it meant, I can't speak for y'all. Let me tell you what it meant for me. Lillian's son had a bunch of scones that he had got from the fair the other night.
The Fisher scones?
Yeah.
Mm.
And they was in the fridge. And yesterday the Seahawks lost. And then at night I spent my time feeling dirty by cheering on the San Francisco 49ers. And then they lost to that team in Denver. And then I just found myself eating scones the rest of the night. You know what I mean? And I don't know if anybody out there knows what I'm talking about. When you just have a rough day and you just eat away your sorrows.
Yes.
That was me eating them scones last night. And I didn't care. And I know this morning I looked and there's like 5 paper rabbits in the garbage. This was a must win, Dave and Colleen. Yeah. They were supposed to win this game against a not so very good Atlanta Falcons team. The Seahawks offense was doing their thing for some reason. Just the defense wasn't really doing that great. Kind of just kind of letting some things happen. It was close towards the end, and then the Seahawks did not score enough. So what ends up happening in this case, Dave, the other team, the Falcons, score more points than the Seahawks.
So this wasn't a Geno thing. His job is still safe.
It really wasn't a Geno thing. I thought Geno and a lot of my buddies, we thought Geno played very well. Yes, it came down to Geno in the clutch, right? He took a sack, and it was a false start, and then he ended up throwing that interception. That was kind of a big one right there, and that's going to probably be the takeaway that most fans have. But it's just unfortunate though, because everything was right. It was a beautiful day at Lumen Field on Sunday. It was the corgi races. The dogs are racing. That's always a good time. You know what I mean?
And it ends with you stuffing yourself with scones. It's really sad.
Yeah, a little bit of butter, a little raspberry jam. Is that how you did it?
See. Okay, I take the little tub of butter,
yeah,
and I bring it out, and I get the scones in there. It's piping hot.
Oh yeah,
And when I put there, so I just, between you and I just scoop the butter and then take a bite at the same time.
You eat butter from the spoon?
Yeah. Go on. I mean, we're going to get.
You were depressed.
We're going to put it out there. Let's put it out there. Let's tell the whole story.
That's like, that's about 500 calories per scone.
Doesn't matter when your team
Don't
loses.
Judge it, boy.
Count.
Real quick, did you get a lot of folks was talking about you and your shoes the other day.
Got so much attention. One of the most popular Dave Ross tweets was dressing up in G's clothes. We should do dress up more often.
Yeah, that would be really interesting little exercise. Actually, it could be part of the new Pro Bowl, right?
Yeah, the new Pro Bowl. If you guys haven't heard, the NFL is doing away with that game that wasn't good, right? It was not good because everybody, all the players are trying to protect themselves. And it ends up being, then why are you in a helmet, shoulder pads, and all the equipment if you're not trying to really play the game? So in this case, it's going to be the Pro Bowl games, right? There's going to be competitions throughout the week. They'll probably let those things out. I'm sure it's going to be flag football will be one of those, quarterback skills and catching and all that stuff.
But they might sprain a fingy with flag football.
You could. wait, real quick.
Yeah.
Flag football can sometimes be dangerous, guys.
I was just talking about the powder puff game I played when I was in 11th grade. A girl broke her wrist. I was sacking quarterbacks. It gets vicious.
It does.
When you're playing football, you can't stick to just pulling someone's flag off. It's not right.
Right? Like, you're trying to pull the flag.
Yeah.
By any means necessary. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I think that this is going to be an opportunity for us to really get excited. I think the NFL is last place when it comes to all-star games. I think the NBA is probably number one. And I think Major League Baseball All-Star Game would be number two. And the NFL is down like number 25.
What do you want to see from them?
You know what? I don't think this is going to get any ratings. I just would just like to say, hey, this person is a Pro Bowl player. They earned that, and that's it.
How about competitive end zone dancing?
I like that.
As one of the events.
Are you serious, bro?
Yeah.
Where did that come from, Dave? Like you,
he's trying
you
to think of games.
Are you thinking about Rihanna at halftime? What made you say something about end zone dancing?
Because I've seen some end zone dancing, and now they're sort of relaxing on the end zone dancing. Why not do a competitive thing where the players can show off what they've rehearsed all year?
Fair. How about we think of a bet that you and I can make?
Mm-hmm.
Loser of the bet has to do a
10-second
end zone dance.
In your shoes,
we did it, and we do it on video, and we let the people see it.
And I'll put it on TikTok.
Fair?
You discuss that with Colleen, and then I'll decide if I want to do this or not.
He won't commit on air.
I will not commit on air. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. We have on the line shoreline firefighter Andrew Leith, who, unlike most firefighters I know, has developed his own smartphone app. Andrew, tell me what you came up with here.
So I started teaching disaster preparedness classes several years ago with our public information officer, and I quickly learned that most people don't know how to turn off their utilities. And most of the time in your normal everyday number of 911 calls, the local fire department can handle whatever the call volume is. But in a natural disaster, we will be overrun. So things like shutting off your gas, power, and water are things that people didn't know. So I developed an app to teach people how to turn off and secure your utilities in case of a natural disaster.
Wonderful idea. I know that when you move into a home, you learn it once, and then you probably won't have to use it for years. And it's like, if somebody asked me today how to shut off the gas, I wouldn't know. When did that aha moment come to you that this would be a useful app?
So I lived in the city of Edmonds for 18 years. I work in Shoreline, where the north border of Seattle. I thought that most people in the city have, the same gas meters, water meters, and all that stuff. So I thought, the information's out there, but nobody seems to look for it on their own. And when it comes time to need that information, the internet and cell towers will probably be down, so you won't be able to find it. So my wife and I moved up to Oak Harbor on Whidbey Island. And I thought, well, the people up here, most of them know what they're doing. And then I was sitting on a campfire with my neighbor, and she said, I grew up in the country. I can grow any type of crop. I can ride a horse bareback, but I have no idea how to start the generator when the power goes out. So that's when I realized, well, there's a need for everywhere in the state, well, everywhere in the country. So that's when I decided to make it an app.
So explain how this works. How does it go about helping you start the generator and turn off the gas?
It shows you sample images of gas meters, electrical panels, water meters, and shows you how to turn those off. And then allows you or someone you know who has this type of knowledge to come in and take photos of your exact gas meter, your exact water meter, your electrical panel, and mark the location of those on a satellite image of your property. You can also enter contact information for that utility. So let's say it's a water line. We go on water leaks all the time. People call 911 when their water lines break. We show up, we shut off their meter, they call their plumber. This app allows the homeowner to locate the meter, shut the meter down, and then under the contacts, just hit send and call whatever plumber you use to come out and fix the water leak.
And it's all stored locally on the phone. So if the cell phone network goes down, you still have the information as long as your phone is charged, of course.
Correct. So the three big ones, the gas, water, and power, that is free. Anyone can download it and anyone can enter that information. And that information is stored on your device and in the cloud. So if you lose your phone and you pull the data onto your new phone, it'll be stored on your phone. You don't need internet access to get to that information.
What immediately came to mind as you were describing that scenario is how much this frees up our fire crews to go to the emergency calls that require professional help. Was that also the intention of this app?
Yes. Yeah, so I'm on the ladder truck at work. I'm assigned to the technical rescue team. I'm assigned to the water rescue team. I'm on the wildland firefighting team. I've been deployed to California multiple times. I'm on the FEMA USAR Washington Task Force 1, which gets deployed anywhere inside the United States for disasters. I have volunteered to go anywhere in the country and help anyone. And most people in this profession would do the same thing. But in the case of a natural disaster, there's not enough of us to go around. So that's where this came from, is we're not going to be able to respond. We are going to be doing much higher need calls if there's a bigger life hazard. So gas flowing in your home is a very serious thing. When the earthquake happens or natural disaster, resources will be overrun. It's impossible for us to be everywhere. So this allows homeowners or occupants to secure their own utilities when we are overrun.
Now, it is not easy to program an app, and you're a firefighter. Did you study programming at the station, or are you a computer programmer on the side, or how did you do it?
No, not at all. So we moved to the country. My wife and I refinanced our house to build a shop, and I talked to the neighbor. She said, "You really need to run with this idea." I went to my wife and said, "Can I use the money for the shop to hire a software developer?" And she said, it's your shop. I don't care. So we spent all of the money plus a lot more. We spent all of our money on a local software development company who built the app. So I had troubles logging into the Zoom interviews I did for the app production meetings.
No. So. But you know your stuff when it comes to natural disasters, so that's why you're the guy behind this. Is this available right now? Can people download it?
Yes, it's available right now on Apple and Android platforms. You can go to Google Play or the App Store and download it. It's called Dwell Secure, D-W-E-L-L, Secure.
Shoreline firefighter and now app developer and tech bro, Andrew Leith. Andrew, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.